which is the event that's been around, it's been commercialized the longest, and so we have the most information about this event. And then a more recently introduced event, MIR 604. The variables that I'm going to talk about in the time that I have today are listed on this slide. We've conducted numerous field and greenhouse studies where we've tried to look at emergence patterns comparing transgenic and isoline plants, the sex ratios of emerged adults, insect size, and then we've taken cohorts of beetles into the lab from those treatments and looked at longevity, fecundity, and especially viability of eggs as well. This is just a quick snapshot of our greenhouse setup that we use. We have very large boxes that we plant corn in, and we can manipulate soil type, plant populations, things like that. And because of the large amount of soil, we get plenty of room for root development and can grow very normal looking plants if you compare them to the field. Our field experiments are grown under commercial conditions, commercial plant populations, and agronomic practices. A couple things before I present any results. For both sets of experiments with these events, we intentionally conduct these experiments under just low to moderate insect pressure, which causes just low to moderate injury. And this is done to try to remove as much as possible potential density-dependent effects that could possibly affect some of the life history traits that we might be measuring. Unlike the previous two talks you just heard, we're using natural populations with no previous exposure to the rootworm-protected BT events. So these are all this data you're going to see is one-time exposure to these events. One result that we saw from both events that I'll also put up front here for you just to keep in mind is that females were almost always significantly larger than males in all of our experiments, and this is very typical of what you see with Western corn rootworm, regardless of whether it comes off of a transgenic plant or a conventional hybrid. The other important thing is within gender, we didn't see any significant differences in beetle size between isoline or transgenic treatments in any of the experiments that we've conducted. So the transgenic exposure does not seem to be affecting beetle size under the population pressure that we're doing these experiments anyway. Okay, so I want to start first by talking about MON863 results. This slide has a lot of information on it. The top part of this slide, this graph right here, is data from the isoline treatment, and then the MON863 treatment is down here. The top graph represents what you typically will see in the Western Corn Belt as far as an emergence curve. The blue part of each bar represents the percentage of males emerging during that period, and the magenta bar is females. We usually see a high proportion of the initial emergence is males, which is right here, and then it typically goes, as you move farther into your emergence curve, you end up with more of a one-to-one emergence ratio, male to female, and then it becomes highly skewed towards females at the end. With MON863, we lost the first part of the emergence curve. Apparently, we had a lot of our mortality occurred right here, and so this significantly affected our overall emergence totals. And if you look at the other thing I should point out is that the vertical axis on these curves is not the same. So the lower curve is a lot less beetles emerging than the upper curve that I'm showing here. But one of the key points is that we moved very quickly with the transgenic event to that one-to-one emergence male versus female ratio, and then it became highly skewed toward females. So your total emergence for the season is more highly skewed towards females in the transgenic than the isoline, even though both curves ended about the same time. The mechanisms regarding this are still unclear. There are some clues out there from some of the other work that's been done. Pete Clark at Nebraska did working in John Foster's lab, looked at larval behavior and documented that there are some very strong behavioral differences of neonates when they're trying to colonize transgenic versus isoline plants. On a regular conventional plant, they will tend to bore right into root tips and go right in the roots. On the transgenic, they will take bites, and if they survive that, they tend to move around and just keep grazing on the outside of the roots but not boring in. So it really strongly appears that they can detect something different about those roots. I've had another graduate student that's looked at, used nonlinear analysis to look at larval development between Monade 63 versus Iceline in different instars, and she found that there were developmental delays taking place. We also have differences in, because of the protandry type of an emergence pattern, males tend to hatch a little earlier and develop a little faster, and there may be differences in exposure to the toxin if that titer changes during the season in these plants. So the mechanism is probably fairly complex, and it's probably a combination of behavioral and physiological interactions of both males and females with the plant. If you look at some of the longevity and ovipositional data, this is a typical experiment that we've seen, or typical data set. Let me explain the diet part here. This is not artificial diet. We used larval diet, just means this is the type of plant that they were reared on, either transgenic or isoline. And then when the adults emerged, they were split into a kind of a complete factorial of all the diets that are available. And we fed them, because the adults are strongly attracted to the ear part of the plant, that's where they usually feed. Adult diet consisted of silks, ear tip tissue, kernels, and then some of the part of the sheath of the ear as well, the green tissue. And this was held constant in most of our experiments, pretty optimal ear tissue, the R2 to R3 growth stage. The adults were transferred eventually after bulk mating into individual pairs in randomly pulled pairs out of those cohorts, were held on soil, and food was changed out of every couple days. And so this is the kind of data that we ended up with. The only time we saw an effect on female lifespan is if they were held on transgenic their whole lifespan. Otherwise, we didn't see any effect. Where we saw the biggest effect was the number of eggs that were laid. And as you can see on the figure here, if you're looking at just isoline lifetime exposure versus transgenic lifetime exposure, we've seen up to almost a 50% reduction in the mean eggs per female. The other interesting thing is that when we have diet switching, and I call it diet switching, it's really, these plants are very, very similar. Theoretically, their genetic background is about the same, except for the transgene that's been inserted. When we switch them, and this is just a one-time diet switch, we end up with some significant effects on egg laying as well. In this particular experiment, the percentage hatch was not great, but it wasn't significantly different among the treatments. This is another field study that we conducted, and this one was a little different. We just maintained the individuals as they emerged on the diet that they were reared on as immatures, and the food senesced over time in the field to try to simulate what the adults would be exposed to over time in their natural environment. If you just focus on the main effects here, the transgenic treatments versus the isoline, you can see that we got a similar trend that we saw in the previous study that I just showed you. The main effect here was that we had females with a longer lifespan on the non-transgenic, they laid more eggs, And in this case, we had a higher percentage hatch as well. And that may be related to the diet differences that we have between these experiments. Okay, let's switch to the MIR experiments where we had similar type designs. Same type of graphs that I showed you before. We got the same typical on the upper curve, same typical emergence curve. The bottom curve with the transgenic was similar to what we saw with MON863, but not quite as extreme. We tend to see, with both of these events, we tend to see some delay before we see initial emergence, and then the peak emergence or 50% emergence seems to be delayed as well. We saw the same shift in overall sex ratio, more towards females, with MIR 604. We got a slightly different result when we looked at longevity. With this event, as long as they stayed on one food their whole life, it didn't seem to impact longevity at all, if you compare the top line with the bottom line here. But the same thing we saw with oviposition with MON863, we're seeing here with longevity. We're seeing some pretty severe effects when we switch diets from a larval to adult. We end up with some significant interactions here, larval-adult interaction, which in a lot of cases reduces the survival time of males and females. Here's some of the fecundity data from this experiment. This is a greenhouse experiment, and in this case we saw no significant differences in egg laying between lifetime exposure of transgenic versus isoline, but again we saw some of the interaction effects when diet switching occurred. And it did actually affect percentage hatch as well. Here's a field experiment with the same design, and we got pretty much the same type of result. There was a slight trend that the isoline laid more eggs, but it wasn't significantly different than the transgenic. But again, one of the diets, especially when we went from isoline as a larva to transgenic in the adult stage, we had a lot lower number of eggs, and then this affected egg hatch as well. So the conclusion so far from this, I think we've consistently seen that larval feeding on event MON863 or MIR 604 may delay initial adult emergence and can increase the proportion of adults that are female. And the data collected to date also suggests that the negative effects on Western corn ringworm fitness from lifetime larval and adult dietary exposure to event MIR 604 may be pretty minimal. This was different than what we saw with the Western corn ringworm on MON863, where we consistently saw a pretty significant reduction in egg laying. The most interesting thing, I think, so far has been that in no-choice tests, female longevity and oviposition appeared to be negatively affected by the larval adult diet switching between the MIR event and the isoline tissue. And we saw a similar trend with MON863 when we just looked at oviposition. Some of the factors in the field that may potentially affect the frequency of adult diet switching, if you think about movement of males and females in the field, I have kind of lifted up here on this slide. So far, no data has been generated that indicates that adults can detect either Cry3BB1 or the Cry3A in above ground tissues in corn, at least at the levels that are expressed in commercial hybrids. And so this suggests that there isn't any repellency, and that the beetles really can't make a choice about which tissue they would like to feed on. There have been various studies conducted in the corn belt on adult movement, and we've always thought they were fairly mobile, and that's being confirmed. It's especially males, tend to be, there's a lot of trivial movement. So I think the fact that they're moving a lot daily would enable them to potentially switch diets a lot during their lifetime. The type of refuge that's deployed could also impact this. And I think in situations where we have a stripped refuge of strips, isolating strips of transgenic and isoline, or a seed mix type refuge, may facilitate diet switching even more. So future considerations, I think with all these new events that are coming on the market now, we're going to have a more of a mosaic of rootworm protected events in the landscape in the future. And right now it's unknown how adult diet switching among these events may impact fitness. It's potentially possible we could have these right next to each other in fields, across the road or across a fence line. And we haven't always really focused on the landscape, I think, dynamics related to this in the past. So I think this might be something we want to look at a little closer in the future in the corn-soybean system. To gain a true measure of population-level fitness in an area, I think we may have to do this. And one of the things we've been talking about to try to manage rootworms more efficiently is maybe to try to lower the rootworm population over an area more than just looking at it on an individual field basis. So questions about whether we're getting either short-term or long-term suppression of beetles when we have this mosaic or not is something I think we maybe should look at more in the future. So with that, I'll take questions if there are any.
Beetle starts every spring when adults from the wheat stem sofla emerge and lay their eggs inside the wheat stems. The larvae develop inside the stems and feed on the parenchyma and vascular tissue until they mature, when they go down to the base of the stem and they girdle it to create a hibernaculum where they will overwinter. So the girdling of the larvae causes the stems to lodge, constituting the most obvious impact of this pest when the lodged stems cannot be harvested. But also, feeding damage to vascular tissue disrupts the nutrient flow to the head, causing a reduction in seed weight. And this has been reported to be between 3 to 22%, depending on environmental conditions and cultivar. Parasitoids sting the sofly larvae through the stems. They paralyze it and they lay an egg on it. And the parasitoid larva then feeds on the sofly larva until it spins a cocoon. And because these insects are bivoltine, each growing season, adults from the first generation.
My topic for today is the parasitization of sugar borer by Cotidia flavipes on rice. In this presentation, we'll talk about the relationship between rice, sugar borer, and Cotidia flavipes, a two-year field experiment. Experiment results about the development and survival of sugar borer on rice. Experiment results of the parasitization of sugar borer by Cotidia flavipes on rice. And a cohort-based age drug model, which is used to simulate the population dynamics of both insects. Sugar borer is an important Lepidopteran pest of rice in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. First and second instar larvae injure the leaf and leaf sheaths of rice. Here I'm showing two second instar larvae inside leaf sheaths. And the third and later instar larvae, they started boring to the stem and destroy the vascular tissue transportation. This is a big larva. And I have a picture of a pupae, and this is an adult. Cotidia flavipes is an introduced parasite of the sugar borer. Female